pride in my floating home. That night he was probably unaware of the latest bit of gossip circulating through town, of the strange goings-on out on the commons. Swarms of grasshoppers had begun to appear in the turnip fields. "The whole face of the earth has been spotted with them," Obed Macy would write. "No person living ever knew them, so numerous. A comet in July, and now a plague of locusts?" As it turned out, things would end up badly for the two ships anchored off the Nantucket Bar on the evening of August 11, 1819. The Chile would not return for another 3.5 years, and then, with only 500 barrels of sperm oil, about a quarter of what was needed to fill a ship her size. For Captain Coffin and his men, it would be a disastrous voyage. But nothing could compare to what fate had in store for the 21 men of the Essex. Chapter 2. Knockdown. On the morning of Thursday, August 12, 1819, a harbor vessel delivered Captain George Pollard, Jr. to the Essex. At 28, Pollard was a young, but not spectacularly young, first-time captain. Over the last 4 years, he had spent all but 7 months aboard the Essex, as second mate and then first mate. Except for her former captain, Daniel Russell, no one knew this ship better than George Pollard. Pollard carried a letter from the Essex's principal owners telling the new captain, in spare, direct prose, exactly what was expected of him. His predecessor, Daniel Russell, had received a similar letter prior to an earlier voyage. It had read, "Respected friend, as thou art master of the ship Essex, now lying without the bar at anchor, our orders are that thou shouldst proceed to sea the first fair wind and proceed for the Pacific Ocean, and endeavor to obtain a load of sperm oil, and when accomplished, to make the best dispatch for this place. Thou art forbidden to hold any illicit trade. Thou art forbidden to carry on thyself, or to suffer any person belonging to the ship Essex, to carry on any trade except it should be necessary for the preservation of the ship Essex or her crew. Wishing thee a short and prosperous voyage, with a full portion of happiness, we remain thy friends. In behalf of the owners of the ship Essex, Gideon Folger, Paul Macy." Pollard felt the full weight of the owner's expectations. He was thinking not only about the voyage ahead, but also about what he was leaving behind. Just 2 months before, he and 19-year-old Mary Riddell had been married in the Second Congregational Church, of which Mary's father, a well-to-do cordwainer, or ropemaker, was a deacon. As he scrambled up the Essex's side, then made his way aft to the quarterdeck, Captain Pollard knew that the entire town was watching him and his men. All summer, ships had been leaving the island, sometimes as many as 4 or 5 a week. But with the departure of the Essex and the Chile, there would be a lull of about a month or so before another whale ship would depart. For the entertainment-starved inhabitants of Nantucket, this would be it for a while. Leaving the island was difficult aboard any whale ship, since most of the crew had no idea of what they were doing. It could be an agony of embarrassment for a captain, as the green hands bumbled their way around the deck or clung white-knuckled to the spars. The whole affair was carried out in the knowledge that the town's old salts, and of course the owners, were watching and criticizing from the shade of the windmills up on Mill Hill. With perhaps a nervous glance townward, Captain George Pollard gave the order to prepare the ship for weighing the anchors. A whale ship, even a small and old whale ship, was a complex and sophisticated piece of equipment. The Essex had 3 masts and a bowsprit. To the mast were fastened a multitude of horizontal spars known as yards, from which the rectangular sails were set. There was so much cordage dedicated to either supporting the spars or controlling the sails, more than 20 in number, that from the perspective of a green hand staring up from the deck, the Essex looked like the web of a giant rope-spinning spider. That each one of these pieces of rope had a name was plainly laughable to a green hand. How could anyone, even after a 3-year voyage, pretend to have any idea of what went where? For young Nantucketers such as Nickerson and his friends, it was particularly devastating, since they had begun this adventure assuming they knew much more than they apparently did. All was bustle, confusion, and awkwardness, that is, on the part of the crew, Nickerson remembered. The officers were smart, active men and were, no doubt, piqued at having such a display of awkwardness in full view of their native town. Since he was required by custom to remain stationed at the quarterdeck, Pollard was all but powerless before this clumsy display. Doing his best to apply some method to the madness was the first mate, Owen Chase, stationed in the forward part of the deck. It was his duty to implement Pollard's orders, and he shouted and cajoled the men as if every hesitation or mistake on their part were a personal insult. Pollard and Chase had been together aboard the Essex since 1815, when Chase, at 18, had signed on as a common sailor. Chase had moved quickly through the ranks. By the next voyage, he was a boat steerer, and now, at only 22, he was the first mate. Matthew Joy, the Essex's second mate, was 4 years older than Chase. If all went well during this voyage, Chase would have a good chance of becoming a captain before he was 25. At 5'10", Chase was tall for the early 19th century. He towered over Captain Pollard, a small man with a tendency toward stoutness. While Pollard's father was also a captain, Chase's father was a farmer. Perhaps because his father was a farmer on an island where seagoing men got all the glory, Chase was fired with more than the usual amount of ambition, and as he started his third voyage, he made no secret of his impatience to become a captain. Two voyages are generally considered sufficient to qualify an active and intelligent young man for command, he would write, in which time he learns from experience and the examples which are set him all that is necessary to be known. He was 6 years younger than Captain Pollard, but Chase felt he had already mastered everything he needed to know to perform Pollard's job. The first mate's cocksure attitude would make it difficult for Pollard, a first-time captain just emerging from the long shadow of a respected predecessor, to assert his own style of command. As the crew assembled spare hawsers and rope in preparation for weighing the anchor, Chase made sure everything was secured about the deck. Then he ordered the men to the windlass, a long horizontally mounted wooden cylinder with a double row of holes at each end. Positioned just forward of the forecastle hatch, the windlass provided the mechanical advantage required to do the heavy lifting aboard the ship. 8 men were stationed at the 2 ends, 4 aft, 4 forward, each holding a wooden handspike. Working the windlass in a coordinated fashion was as challenging as it was backbreaking. To perform this, the sailors must give a sudden jerk at the same instant, went one account, in which movement they are regulated by a sort of song or howl pronounced by one of their number. Once the men had pulled the slack out of the anchor cable, or hove short, it was time for crew members who had been positioned aloft to loosen the sails from their ties. Pollard then ordered Chase, whom, in accordance with custom, he always addressed as Mr. Chase, to heave up the anchor and to let him know when it was away. Now the real work began, a process, given the rawness of the Essex's crew, that probably took an excruciatingly long time to perform, inching the huge, mud-dripping anchor up to the bow. Eventually, however, the anchor was lashed to the bulwarks, with the ring at the end of its shank secured to a projecting timber known as a cathead. Now Pollard's and Chase's public agony began in earnest. There were additional sails to be set in the gradually building southwesterly breeze. A crack crew would have had all the canvas flying in an instant. In the Essex's case, it wasn't until they had sailed completely around Great Point, more than 9 miles from where they'd weighed anchor, that the upper or topgallant sails were, according to Nickerson, set and all sails trimmed in the breeze. All the while, Pollard and his officers knew that the town's spyglasses had been following them for each and every awful moment. As cabin boy, Nickerson had to sweep the decks and coil any stray lines. When he paused for a few seconds to watch his beloved island fade from view behind him, he was accosted by the first mate, who, in addition to cuffing him about the ears, snarled, "You boy, Tom, bring back your broom here and sweep clean. The next time I have to speak to you, your hide shall pay for it, my lad." Nickerson and his Nantucket friends may have thought they knew Chase prior to their departure, but they now realized that, as another young Nantucketer had discovered, at sea, things appear different. The mate of a Nantucket whale ship routinely underwent an almost Jekyll and Hyde transformation when he left his island home, stepping out of his mild Quaker skin to become a vociferous martinet. You will often hear a Nantucket mother boast that her son, who is met of a ship, is a real spitfire, William Comstock wrote, meaning that he is a cruel tyrant, which on that island is considered the very acme of human perfection. And so Nickerson saw Owen Chase change from a perfectly reasonable young man with a new wife named Peggy to a bully who had no qualms about using force to obtain obedience and who swore in a manner that shocked these boys who had been brought up, for the most part, by their mothers and grandmothers. Although but a few hours before I had been so eager to go on this voyage, Nickerson remembered, there now seemed a sudden gloom to spread over me. A not very pleasing prospect was truly before me, that of a long voyage and a hard overseer. This to a boy of my years who had never been used to hear such language or threats before. It was more than a realization that the whaling life might be harsher than he had been led to believe. Now that the island had slipped over the horizon, Nickerson began to understand, as only an adolescent on the verge of adulthood can understand, that the carefree days of childhood were gone forever. Then it was that I, for the first time, realized that I was alone upon a wide and an unfeeling world, without one relative or friend to bestow one kind word upon me. Not till then did Nickerson begin to appreciate the full sacrifice that I had made. That evening the men were divided into two shifts, or watches. With the exception of the idlers, those such as the cook, steward, and cooper, or barrelmaker, who worked in the day and slept at night, all the men served alternating four-hour stints on deck. Like children picking teams on a playground, the mate and second mate took turns choosing the men who would serve in their watches. The first step taken by the officers, said William Comstock, is to discover who were natives of the island and who were strangers. The honor of being a Roman citizen was not, in days of yore, so enviable a distinction as it is on board one of these ships to be a native of that sandbank, yclept Nantucket. Once the Nantucketers had all been picked, with Nickerson taken by Chase, the mates chose among the Cape Codders and the blacks. Next came the choice of oarsmen for the whaleboats, a contest that involved both mates and also Captain Pollard, who headed up his own boat. Since these were the men with whom a mate or a captain was going into battle, he took the selection of the whaleboat crew very seriously. There was much competition among the officers, a whaleman remembered, and evidently some anxiety, with a little ill-concealed jealousy of feeling. Once again, each officer attempted to man his boat with as many fellow Nantucketers as he could. Nickerson found himself on Chase's boat with the Nantucketer Benjamin Lawrence as a boat steerer. Nickerson's friend and the captain's cousin, Owen Coffin, was assigned to Pollard's boat along with several other Nantucketers. Matthew Joy, who as second mate was the lowest-ranking officer, was left without a single islander on his boat. The three remaining men not chosen as oarsmen became the Essex's shipkeepers. It was their duty to handle the Essex when whales were being hunted. The first day of a whaling voyage included yet another ritual, the captain's speech to the crew. The tradition was said to date back to when Noah first closed the doors of the ark and was the way the captain officially introduced himself. It was a performance that all aboard the ship, officers and green hands alike, attended with great interest. As soon as Pollard began to speak, Nickerson was impressed by the difference between the captain and the first mate. Instead of shouting and cursing at the men, Pollard spoke without overbearing display or ungentlemanlike language. He simply stated that the success of the voyage would depend on the crew and that the officers should be strictly obeyed. Any sailor who willfully disregarded an order, Pollard told them, would have to answer not just to the officers, but to him. He then dismissed the men with the words, "Set the watch, Mr. Chase." The men of the Essex ate and slept in three different areas: the captain's and mate's cabins in the aft portion of the ship, steerage, where the boat steerers and young Nantucketers lived, just forward of the officers, and the forecastle, the cramped, poorly lit quarters in the extreme forward part of the vessel, separated from steerage by the blubber room. The divide between the forecastle and the other living quarters was not just physical, but also racial. According to Addison Pratt, a greenhand on a Nantucket ship in 1820, the forecastle was filled with darkies, while the white sailors who weren't officers lived in steerage. Reflecting the prejudices typical of a Nantucket whaleman, Thomas Nickerson considered himself fortunate indeed to escape being so closely penned up with so large a number of blacks in the Essex's forecastle. But the forecastle had its merits. Its isolation, the only way to enter it was from a hatchway in the deck, meant that its occupants could create their own world. When he sailed on a merchant voyage in the 1830s, Richard Henry Dana, the author of 2 Years Before the Mast, preferred the camaraderie of the forecastle to steerage, where you are immediately under the eye of the officers, cannot dance, sing, play, smoke, make a noise, or growl, i.e. complain, or take an other sailor's pleasure. In the forecastle, the African-American sailors indulged in the ancient seafaring tradition of yarning, swapping stories about passages, shipmates, and wrecks, along with other tales of the sea. They danced and sang songs, often accompanied by a fiddle. They prayed to their god, and in keeping with yet another ocean-going tradition, they second-guessed the captain and his officers. By the following morning, many of the green hands found themselves in the throes of seasickness, rolling and tumbling about the decks almost ready to die or be cast into the sea, Nickerson remembered. Nantucketers had what they considered a surefire cure for seasickness, a treatment that more delicate mortals might have considered even worse than the malady. The sufferer was made to swallow a piece of pork fat tied to a string, which was then pulled back up again. If the symptoms returned, the process was repeated. Chase was not about to coddle his queasy crew. That morning at 8 bells sharp, he ordered all hands to clear the decks and prepare the ship for whaling. Even though the whale population in the waters to the southeast of the island along the edges of the Gulf Stream had been greatly diminished over the years, it was still quite possible to come across what Nantucketers called a shoal of sperm whales. Woe to the crew that was not ready when a whale was sighted. But for a whale to be sighted, a lookout had to be positioned aloft. Not a pleasing prospect for a crew of seasick greenhands. Every man was expected to climb to the head of the mainmast and spend 2 hours in search of whales. Some of the men were so weak from vomiting that they doubted they had the strength to hold on to a pitching spar for 2 hours. One of them, Nickerson said, even went so far as to protest that it was altogether absurd and unreasonable to expect them to look for whales, and that he, for one, should not go, and he hoped the captain would not expect it of him. The fact that this unnamed sailor specifically mentioned the captain instead of the first mate suggests that he was Pollard's cousin, 17-year-old Owen Coffin. Miserable and genuinely fearful for his life, Coffin may have made a desperate, ill-advised appeal to his kinsman for a reprieve from the first mate's discipline. But it was futile. According to Nickerson, whose narrative is not without irony, there followed a few soft words from the officers, along with some little challenging of their spirits. And it wasn't long before all the green hands had taken a turn at the masthead. Like a skier traversing the face of a mountain, a Nantucket whale ship took an indirect route toward Cape Horn, a course determined by the prevailing winds of the Atlantic Ocean. First, pushed by the westerlies, the ship sailed south and east toward Europe and Africa. There she picked up winds called the northeast trades, which took her back across the ocean again in the direction of South America. After crossing the equator in an often airless region known as the doldrums, she worked her way south and west through the southeast trades into an area of variable winds. Then she encountered the band of westerlies that could make rounding the Horn so difficult. On the first leg of this southern slide down the Atlantic, there were provisioning stops at the Azores and Cape Verde Islands, where vegetables and livestock could be purchased for much less than they cost on Nantucket. These stops also gave the whalemen the opportunity to ship back any oil they might have obtained during their cruise across the Atlantic. On August 15th, 3 days out of Nantucket, the Essex was making good time toward the Azores, with the wind out of the southwest, coming directly over her starboard side, or beam. Having left Nantucket late in the season, the officers hoped to make up lost time. As usual, three topgallant sails were pulling from the upper yards, but on this day the Essex also carried at least one studding sail, a rectangle of canvas mounted on a special spar temporarily fitted to the end of the fore topsail yard. Whale ships rarely set their studding sails, especially when they were in a region where whales might be sighted. Whereas ships in the China trade lived and died by how quickly they delivered their cargo, whalers were, for the most part, in no particular hurry. Use of the studding sails meant that a captain wanted to wring the last possible quarter knot of speed from his ship. The sails were difficult to set and even harder to take down, especially with an inexperienced crew. Since the sails' booms projected out beyond the yards, there was a danger of dipping them into the water if the ship should begin to roll from side to side. For a whale ship full of greenhands to approach the often tempestuous waters of the Gulf Stream with her studding sails flying indicated an aggressive, if not foolhardy, attitude on the part of her commander. With the extra sail area catching the wind, the Essex was moving well, probably at 6 to 8 knots. The lookout spotted a ship ahead. Pollard ordered the helmsman to steer for her, and soon the Essex had caught up to what proved to be the whale ship Midas, 5 days out of New Bedford. Captain Pollard and the captain of the Midas exchanged shouted pleasantries, along with estimates of their longitude, and the Essex was soon pulling ahead, her entire crew undoubtedly enjoying the fact that their ship had proved to be what Nickerson called the fastest sailer of the two. Later that day, the weather began to deteriorate. Clouds moved into the sky, and it grew suspiciously dark to the southwest. The sea became very rough, Nickerson remembered, which caused the ship to roll and tumble heavily. A storm seemed imminent, but the Essex continued to carry a press of sail throughout the night, and the officers had no cause to disturb the hands, except for their respective watches. By the next morning, they were in the Gulf Stream, and it was raining steadily. Nantucketers knew this eerily warm ocean current better than perhaps any other group of mariners. In the 18th century, they had hunted sperm whales along its margins from Carolina to Bermuda. In 1786, Benjamin Franklin, whose mother, Abiah Folger, had been born on Nantucket, had used knowledge gleaned from his Nantucket cousin, whaling Captain Timothy Folger, to create the first chart of the Gulf Stream. Many considerations, both nautical and psychological, went into a decision to shorten sail. No captain wanted to be needlessly timid, yet taking unnecessary risks, especially at the beginning of a voyage that might last as long as 3 years, was unwise. At some point, the conditions became so rough that Pollard elected to take in the foreign mizzen topgallant sails, yet to leave flying the main topgallant and also the studding sails, usually the first sails taken down in worsening weather. Pollard may have wanted to see how the Essex performed when pushed to the limit. They sailed on, refusing to back down. According to Chase, they could see it coming, a large black cloud rushing toward them from the southwest. Now was surely the time to shorten sail. But once again, they waited, deciding the cloud was an inconsequential gust. They would ride it out. As Chase would later admit, they miscalculated altogether as to the strength and violence of it. In delaying even for a second, shortening sail in the face of an approaching squall, Pollard was now flaunting his disregard of traditional seafaring wisdom. The officers of the British Navy had a maxim: never to be overtaken unprepared by a squall, as never to be surprised by an enemy. It was said that the sharper and more defined the storm cloud, the worse the wind. Thunder and lightning were also bad signs. When jagged streaks of lightning began to crackle out of the forbidding black sky and thunder boomed, Pollard finally began to issue orders. But it was too late. In the face of an approaching squall, there were two options: either to point the ship into the oncoming wind to relieve the pressure on the sails by letting them luff, or to turn almost 180 degrees in the opposite direction, away from the wind, and let the storm blow the ship with it. This relieved the pressure on the forward sails as they became partially becalmed in the shelter of the after ones. In the merchant service, in which ships were typically undermanned, some captains favored heading into the wind, what they called luffing through a squall, in part because heading up is the natural tendency of a sailing ship in a gust. Most captains, however, favored turning away from the wind, a strategy that required them to anticipate the arrival of the squall as the crew shortened the upper and aft sails. To attempt to bear away from the wind in the last few seconds before being struck by a squall was held to show a poor appreciation of the squall, or a lack of watchfulness. This was precisely what happened to the Essex. As the squall approached, the helmsman was ordered to turn away from the direction of the wind and run before it. Unfortunately, it took time for a ship the size of the Essex to respond to her rudder. When the gust slammed into the ship, she had just begun to turn and was sideways to the wind, the worst possible position. For the green hands, the sound alone was terrifying. The shrieking of the wind across the rigging, and then a frenzied flapping of sails and creaking of the stays and masts. The Essex began to lurch to leeward. Slowly at first, the ponderous weight of the ship's keel and ballast, not to mention the tons of stores stowed in her hold, refusing at first to yield. But then as the wind increased, the ship inevitably succumbed to the merciless pressure of the wind. When a ship is heeled over by 45 degrees or more, her hull might be compared to a fat man on the short end of a lopsided seesaw. No matter how much he weighs, if the end of the seesaw on the other side of the pivot point is long enough, it becomes a lever that will eventually lift him up into the air as the distant tip of the seesaw settles softly to the ground. In the case of the Essex, the masts and their wind-pressed sails became levers, prying the hull toward the point of no return, forcing it over until the tips of the yards were buried in the water. The Essex had been rolled almost 90 degrees onto her side, knocked over on her beam ends, in the language of the sea. Those on deck clung to the nearest fixture, fearful that they might fall down into the lee scuppers, now under knee-deep water. Those below deck did their best to shield themselves from objects falling down around them. If he hadn't abandoned it already, the ship's cook was doing his best to scramble out of the cookhouse, the heavy stove and cookware threatening to burst through its frail wooden sides. The two whaleboats on the Essex's port side had disappeared beneath the waves, pressed underwater by the massive weight of the capsized ship. According to Chase, the whole ship's crew were for a short time thrown into the utmost consternation and confusion. Yet amid all the chaos there was, at least on deck, a sudden sense of calm. When a ship suffers a knockdown, her hull acts as a barrier against the wind and rain. Even though the ship had been slammed against the water, the men were temporarily sheltered from the howling forces of the wind. Pollard took the opportunity to pull the crew back together. The cool and undismayed countenance of the captain, Nickerson remembered, soon brought all to their sober senses. The order was given to let go all the halyards and let the sheets run, but the ship lay so far upon her side that nothing would run down as desired. If the squall continued to pin her on her beam ends, the ship would begin to settle into the water as the sea rushed into the hull through her open hatchways. The longer she was over on her side, the greater the chances of the ballast and stores in her hold shifting to leeward, a disastrous turn of events from which she might never recover. Already the waves had wiped the cookhouse almost completely off the deck. As a last resort, it might be necessary to cut away the masts. The rain poured down and the lightning flashed, and time slowed to a crawl as the men clung to the weather rail. But before the axes came into play, the ship twitched back to life. The men could feel it in their hands and feet and in the pits of their stomachs, an easing of the awful strain. They waited for another gust to slam the ship back down again. But no, the ballast continued to exert its gravitational pull, lifting the three masts until the yards came clear of the water. As the masts swung into the sky, seawater rushed across the deck and out the scuppers. The Essex shuddered to the vertical and was a ship again. Now that the hull was no longer acting as a shield, the officers quickly realized that the squall had passed. But even if the wind had diminished, it was still blowing hard. The ship's bow was now pointed into the wind, the sails blown back against the masts. The rigging creaked in an eerie, unfamiliar way as the hull wallowed in the rain-whipped waves. The deck shifted and the green hands temporarily lost their balance. This time the ship wasn't going over, she was going backward, water boiling up over the quarterdeck as her broad transom was pushed back against the waves, pummeling the spare whaleboat stored off the stern. Going backward in a square-rigged ship was dangerous. The sails were plastered against the masts, making it almost impossible to furl them. The pressure placed an immense amount of strain on the stays and spars. Since the rigging had not been designed for loads coming from this direction, all three masts might come tumbling down, domino fashion, across the deck. Already the windows in the stern were threatening to burst open and flood the captain's cabin. There was also the danger of breaking the ship's tall, narrow rudder, which became useless as water pressed against it. Eventually the Essex's bow fell off to leeward, her sails filled, and she was once again making forward progress. Now the crew could do what they should have done before the storm, shorten sail. As the men aloft wrestled with the canvas, the wind shifted into the northwest and the skies began to brighten. But the mood aboard the Essex sank into one of gloom. The ship had been severely damaged. Several sails, including both the main topgallant and the studding sail, had been torn into useless tatters. The cookhouse had been destroyed. The two whaleboats that had been hung off the port side of the ship had been torn from their davits and washed away, along with all their gear. The spare boat on the stern had been crushed by the waves. That left only two workable boats, and a whaleship required a minimum of three, plus two spares. Although the Essex's stern boat could be repaired, they would be without a single spare boat. Captain Pollard stared at the splintered mess and declared that they would be returning to Nantucket for repairs. His first mate, however, disagreed. Chase urged that they continue on despite the damage. The chances were good, he insisted, that they would be able to obtain spare whaleboats in the Azores, where they would soon be stopping to procure fresh provisions. Joy sided with his fellow mate. The captain's will was normally the law of the ship, but instead of ignoring his two younger mates, Pollard paused to consider their arguments. 4 days into his first command, Captain Pollard reversed himself. After some little reflection and a consultation with his officers, Nickerson remembered, it was deemed prudent to continue on our course and trust to fortune and a kind providence to make up our loss. The excuse given to the crew was that with the wind now out of the northwest, it would have taken too long to return to Nantucket. Nickerson suspected that Chase and Joy had other motives. Both knew that the men had not taken kindly to their treatment by the mates. Seeing the knockdown as a bad omen, many of the sailors had become sullen and sour. If they returned to Nantucket, some of the crew would jump ship. Despite the seriousness of the loss of the whaleboats, it was not the time to return to port. Not surprisingly, given that he was the object of much of the crew's discontent, Chase, in his own account of the accident, never mentions that Pollard originally proposed turning back. As Chase would have it, the knockdown was only a minor inconvenience. We repaired our damage with little difficulty and continued on our course. But Nickerson knew differently. Many of the Essex's men were profoundly shaken by the knockdown and wanted to get off the ship. Whenever they passed a homeward-bound vessel, the green hands would lament in the words of one, "Oh, how I wish I was on board with them going home again, for I am heartily sick of these whaling voyages," even though they had not yet even seen a whale. Chapter 3. First Blood. After a provisioning stop in the Azores, which provided plenty of fresh vegetables but no spare whaleboats, the Essex headed south toward the Cape Verde Islands. 2 weeks later, they sighted Boa Vista Island. In contrast to the Azores' green abundant hills, the slopes of the Cape Verdes were brown and sere, with no trees to offer relief from the burning subtropical sun. Pollard intended to obtain some hogs at the island of Mayo a few miles to the southwest. The next morning, as they approached the island, Nickerson noticed that Pollard and his mates were strangely animated, speaking to each other with a conspiratorial excitement as they passed a spyglass back and forth, taking turns studying something on the beach. What Nickerson termed the cause of their glee remained a mystery to the rest of the crew until they came close enough to the island to see that a whaleship had been run up onto the beach. Here, perhaps, was a source of some additional whaleboats. something the men of the Essex needed much more desperately than pork. Before Pollard could dispatch one of his own boats to the wreck, a whaleboat was launched from the beach and made its way directly toward the Essex. Aboard the boat was the acting American consul, Ferdinand Gardner. He explained that the wrecked whaler was the Archimedes of New York. While approaching the harbor, she had struck a submerged rock, forcing the captain to run her up onto the beach before she was a total loss. Gardner had purchased the wreck, but he had only a single whaleboat left to sell. While one was better than nothing, the Essex would still be dangerously low on boats. With this latest addition, and an old and leaky addition at that, the Essex would now have a total of 4 whaleboats. That would leave her with only 1 spare. In a business as dangerous as whaling, boats were so frequently damaged in their encounters with whales that many whale ships were equipped with as many as 3 spare boats. With a total of only 4 boats, the crew of the Essex would have scant margin for error. That was disturbing. Even the greenhands knew that one day their lives could depend on the condition of these fragile cockle shells. Pollard purchased the whaleboat, then sailed the Essex into the cove that served as Mayo's harbor, where pointed hills of bone-white salt, procured from salt ponds in the interior of the island, added a sense of desolation to the scene. The Essex anchored beside another Nantucket whale ship, the Atlantic, which was offloading more than 300 barrels of oil for shipment back to the island. Whereas Captain Barzilai Coffin and his crew could boast of the 7 or so whales they'd killed since leaving Nantucket on the 4th of July, the men of the Essex were still putting their ship back together after the knockdown in the Gulf Stream and had yet to sight a whale. White beans were the medium of exchange on Mayo, and with a cask of beans aboard, Pollard took a whaleboat in to procure some hogs. Nickerson was at the aft oar. The harbor was without any docks or piers, and in the high surf, bringing a whaleboat into shore was exceedingly tricky. Even though they approached the beach at the best possible part of the harbor, Pollard and his men ran into trouble. "Our boat was instantly capsized and overset in the surf," Nickerson recalled, "and thrown upon the beach, bottom upwards. The lads did not much mind this, for none were hurt, but they were greatly amused to see the captain get so fine a ducking." Pollard traded 1.5 barrels of beans for 30 hogs, whose squeals and grunts and filth turned the deck of the Essex into a barnyard. The impressionable Nickerson was disturbed by the condition of these animals. He called them almost skeletons, and noted that their bones threatened to pierce through their skin as they walked about the ship. Not until the Essex had crossed the equator and reached 30 degrees south latitude, approximately halfway between Rio de Janeiro and Buenos Aires, did the lookout sight the first whale of the voyage. It required sharp eyes to spot a whale's spout, a faint puff of white on the distant horizon lasting only a few seconds. But that was all it took for the lookout to bellow, "There she blows," or just, "Blows!" After more than 3 whaleless months at sea, the officer on deck shouted back in excitement, "Where away?" The lookout's subsequent commentary not only directed the helmsman toward the whales, but also worked the crew into an ever-increasing frenzy. If he saw a whale leap into the air, the lookout cried, "There she breaches!" If he caught a glimpse of the whale's horizontal tail, he shouted, "There goes Flukes!" Any indication of spray or foam elicited the cry, "There's white water!" If he saw another spout, it was back to "Blows!" Under the direction of the captain and the mates, the men began to prepare the whaleboats. Tubs of harpoon line were placed into them. The sheaths were taken off the heads of the harpoons, or irons, which were hastily sharpened one last time. All was life and bustle, remembered one former whaleman. Pollard's was the single boat kept on the starboard side. Chase's was on the aft larboard, or port quarter. Joy's was just forward of Chase's and known as the waste boat. Once within a mile of the shoal of whales, the ship was brought to a near standstill by backing the mainsail. The mate climbed into the stern of his whaleboat, and the boat steerer took his position in the bow as the 4 oarsmen remained on deck and lowered the boat into the water with a pair of block-and-tackle systems known as the falls. Once the boat was floating in the water beside the ship, the oarsmen, either sliding down the falls or climbing down the side of the ship, joined the mate and the boat steerer. An experienced crew could launch a rigged whaleboat from the davits in under a minute. Once all three whaleboats were away, it was up to the three shipkeepers to tend to the Essex. At this early stage in the attack, the mate or captain stood at the steering oar in the stern of the whaleboat, while the boat steerer manned the forwardmost or harpooner's oar. Aft of the boat steerer was the bow oarsman, usually the most experienced foremast hand in the boat. Once the whale had been harpooned, it would be his job to lead the crew in pulling in the whale line. Next was the midships oarsman, who worked the longest and heaviest of the lateral oars, up to 18 feet long and 45 pounds. Next was the tub oarsman. He managed the two tubs of whale line. It was his job to wet the line with a small bucket-like container called a piggin, once the whale was harpooned. This wetting prevented the line from burning from the friction as it ran out around the loggerhead, an upright post mounted on the stern of the boat. Aft of the tub oarsman was the after oarsman. He was usually the lightest of the crew, and it was his job to make sure the whale line didn't tangle as it was hauled back into the boat. Three of the oars were mounted on the starboard side of the boat, and two were on the port side. If the mate shouted, "Pull three," only those men whose oars were on the starboard side began to row. "Pull two," directed the tub oarsman and bow oarsman, whose oars were on the port side, to row. Avast meant to stop rowing, while stern all told them to begin rowing backward until sternway had been established. "Give way all" was the order with which the chase began, telling the men to start pulling together, the after oarsman setting the stroke that the other four followed. With all five men pulling at the oars and the mate or captain urging them on, the whaleboat flew like a slender missile over the wave tops. The competition among the boat crews on a whale ship was always spirited. To be the fastest gave the six men bragging rights over the rest of the ship's crew. The pecking order of the Essex was about to be decided. With nearly a mile between the ship and the whales, the three crews had plenty of space to test their speed. This trial, more than any other during our voyage, Nickerson remembered, was the subject of much debate and excitement among our crews, for neither was willing to yield the palm to the other. As the unsuspecting whales moved along at between 3 and 4 knots, the three whaleboats bore down on them at 5 or 6 knots. Even though all shared in the success of any single boat, no one wanted to be passed by the others. Boat crews were known to foul one another deliberately as they raced side by side behind the giant flukes of a sperm whale. Sperm whales are typically underwater for 10 to 20 minutes, although dives of up to 90 minutes have been reported. The whaleman's rule of thumb was that before diving, a whale blew once for each minute it would spend underwater. Whalemen also knew that while underwater, the whale continued at the same speed and in the same direction as it had been traveling before the dive. Thus, an experienced whaleman could calculate with remarkable precision where a submerged whale was likely to reappear. Nickerson was the after oarsman on Chase's boat, placing him just forward of the first mate at the steering oar. Chase was the only man in the boat who could actually see the whale up ahead. While each mate or captain had his own style, they all coaxed and cajoled their crews with words that evoked the savagery, excitement, and the almost erotic bloodlust associated with pursuing one of the largest mammals on the planet. Adding to the tension was the need to remain as quiet as possible, so as not to alarm or galley the whale. William Comstock recorded the whispered words of a Nantucket mate. "Do for heaven's sake, Spring. The boat don't move. You're all asleep. See, see. There she lies. Scoat, scoat. I love you, my dear fellows. Yes, yes, I do. I'll do anything for you. I'll give you my heart's blood to drink. Only take me up to this whale. Only this time, for this once. Pull. Oh, St. Peter, St. Jerome, St. Stephen, St. James, St. John, the devil on two sticks. Carry me up. Oh, let me tickle him. Let me feel of his ribs. There, there, go on. Oh, 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 most on, most on. Stand up, Starbuck, the harpooner. Don't hold your iron that way. Put one hand over the end of the pole. Now, now, look out. Dart, dart." As it turned out, Chase's crew proved the fastest that day, and soon they were within harpooning distance of the whale. Now the attention turned to the boat steerer, who had just spent more than a mile rowing as hard as he possibly could. His hands were sore and the muscles in his arms were trembling with exhaustion. All the while he had been forced to keep his back turned to a creature that was now within a few feet, or possibly inches of him, its tail, more than 12 feet across, working up and down within easy reach of his head. He could hear it, the hollow, wet roar of the whale's lungs pumping air in and out of its 60-ton body. But for Chase's novice harpooner, the 20-year-old Benjamin Lawrence, the mate himself was as frightening as any whale. Having been a boat steerer on the Essex's previous voyage, Chase had definite ideas on how a whale should be harpooned and maintained a continual patter of barely audible, expletive-laced advice. Lawrence tucked the end of his oar handle under the boat's gunwale, then braced his leg against the thigh thwart and took up the harpoon. There it was, the whale's black body glistening in the sun. The blowhole was on the front left side of the head, and the spout enveloped Lawrence in a foul-smelling mist that stung his skin. By hurling the harpoon, he would transform this gigantic, passive creature into an angry, panicked monster that could easily dispatch him into the hereafter with a single swipe of that massive tail. Or even worse, the whale might turn around and come at them with its tooth-studded jaw opened wide. New boat steerers had been known to faint dead away when first presented with the terrifying prospect of attaching themselves to an infuriated sperm whale. As Lawrence stood at the tossing bow, waves breaking around him, he knew that the mate was analyzing every one of his movements. If he let Chase down now, there would be hell to pay. "Give it to him!" Chase bawled. "Give it to him!" Lawrence hadn't moved when there was a sudden splintering crack and crunch of cedar boards, and he and the other 5 men were airborne. A second whale had come up from beneath them, giving their boat a tremendous whack with its tail and pitching them into the sky. The entire side of the whaleboat was stove in, and the men, some of whom could not swim, clung to the wreck. "I presume the monster was as much frightened as ourselves," Nickerson commented, for he disappeared almost instantly after a slight flourish of his huge tail. To their amazement, no one was injured. Pollard and Joy abandoned the hunt and returned to pick up Chase's crew. It was a dispiriting way to end the day, especially since they were once again down a whaleboat, a loss that, in Nickerson's words, seemed to threaten the destruction of our voyage. Several days after Chase's boat was repaired, the lookout once again sighted whales. The boats were dispatched, a harpoon was hurled, successfully, and the whale line went whizzing out until it was finally snubbed at the loggerhead, launching the boat and crew on the voyage's first Nantucket sleigh ride, as it would come to be called. Merchant seamen spoke derisively about the slow speeds of the average bluff-bowed whale ship, but the truth of the matter was that no other sailors in the early 19th century experienced the speeds of Nantucket whalemen. And instead of doing it in the safe confines of a large 3-masted ship, the Nantucketer traveled in a 25-foot boat crammed with half a dozen men, rope, and freshly sharpened harpoons and lances. The boat rocked from side to side and bounced up and down as the whale dragged it along at speeds that would have left the fleetest naval frigate wallowing in its wake. When it came to sheer velocity over the water, a Nantucketer, pinned to the flank of a whale that was pulling him miles and miles from a whale ship that was already hundreds of miles from land, was the fastest seaman in the world, traveling at 15, some claimed as many as 20, bone-jarring knots. The harpoon did not kill the whale. It was simply the means by which a whaleboat crew attached itself to its prey. After letting the creature tire itself out, by sounding to great depths or simply tearing along the water's surface, the men began to haul themselves, inch by inch, to within stabbing distance of the whale. By this point, the boat steerer and the mate had traded places, a miraculous feat in its own right on a craft as small and tender as a whaleboat. Not only did these 2 men have to contend with a violent slapping of the boat through the waves, which could be so severe that nails started from the planks in the bow and stern, but they had to stay clear of the whale line, quivering like a piano wire down the center line of the boat. Eventually, however, the boat steerer made it aft to the steering oar, and the mate, who was always given the honor of the kill, took up his position in the bow. If the whale was proving too spirited, the mate would hobble it by taking up a boat spade and hacking away at the tendons in the tail. Then he'd take up the 11 to 12 foot long killing lance, its pedal-shaped blade designed for piercing a whale's vital organs. But finding the life of a giant swimming mammal encased in a thick layer of blubber was not easy. Sometimes the mate would be forced to stab it as many as 15 times, probing for a group of coiled arteries in the vicinity of the lungs with a violent churning motion that soon surrounded the whaleboat in a rushing river of bright red blood. When the lance finally found its mark, the whale would begin to choke on its own blood, its spout transformed into a 15 to 20 foot geyser of gore that prompted the mate to shout, "Chimneys afire!" As the blood rained down on them, the men took up the oars and backed furiously away, then paused to watch as the whale went into what was known as its flurry. Beating the water with its tail, snapping at the air with its jaws, even as it regurgitated large chunks of fish and squid, the creature began to swim in an ever-tightening circle. Then, just as abruptly as the attack had begun with the first thrust of the harpoon, it ended. The whale fell motionless and silent, a giant black corpse floating fin up in a slick of its own blood and vomit. This may have been the first time Thomas Nickerson had ever helped kill a warm-blooded animal. Back on Nantucket, where the largest wild quadruped was the Norway rat, there were no deer or even rabbits to hunt. And as any hunter knows, killing takes some getting used to. Even though this brutal and bloody display was the supposed dream of every young man from Nantucket, the sentiments of an 18-year-old greenhand, Enoch Cloud, who kept a journal during his voyage on a whale ship, are telling. "It is painful to witness the death of the smallest of God's created beings, much more one in which life is so vigorously maintained as the whale. And when I saw this, the largest and most terrible of all created animals bleeding, quivering, dying a victim to the cunning of man, my feelings were indeed peculiar." The dead whale was usually towed back to the ship head first. Even with all five men rowing, the mate at the steering oar sometimes lending a hand to the after oarsman, a boat towing a whale could go no faster than 1 mile per hour. It was dark by the time Chase and his men reached the ship. Now it was time to butcher the body. The crew secured the whale to the Essex's starboard side with the head toward the stern. Then they lowered the cutting stage, a narrow plank upon which the mates balanced as they cut up the body. Although the stripping of a whale's blubber has been compared to the peeling of an orange, it was a little less refined than that. First, the mates hacked a hole in the whale's side just above the fin, into which was inserted a giant hook suspended from the mast. Then the immense power of the ship's windlass was brought to bear, heeling the ship over on its side as the block and tackle system attached to the hook creaked with strain. Next, the mates cut out the start of a 5-foot-wide strip of the blubber adjacent to the hook. Pulled by the tackle attached to the windlass, the strip was gradually torn from the whale's carcass, slowly spinning it around until a 20-foot-long strip, dripping with blood and oil, was suspended from the rigging. This blanket piece was severed from the whale and lowered into the blubber room below decks to be cut into more manageable pieces. Back at the corpse, the blubber ripping continued. Once the whale had been completely stripped of blubber, it was decapitated. A sperm whale's head accounts for close to a third of its length. The upper part of the head contains the case, a cavity filled with up to 500 gallons of spermaceti, a clear, high-quality oil that partially solidifies on exposure to air. After the ship's system of blocks and tackles hauled the head up onto the deck, the men cut a hole in the top of the case and used buckets to remove the oil. One or two men might then be ordered to climb into the case to make sure all the spermaceti had been retrieved. Spillage was inevitable, and soon the decks were a slippery mess of oil and blood. Before cutting loose the whale's mutilated corpse, the mates probed its intestinal tract with a lance, searching for an opaque, ash-colored substance called ambergris. Thought to be the result of indigestion or constipation on the part of the whale, ambergris is a fatty substance used to make perfume and was worth more than its weight in gold. By now, the two immense, four-barreled iron tripods were full of pieces of blubber. To hasten the trying-out process, the blubber was chopped into foot-square hunks, then cut through into inch-thick slabs that resembled the fanned pages of a book and were known as Bible leaves. A whale's blubber bears no similarity to the fat reserves of terrestrial animals. Rather than soft and flabby, it is tough, almost impenetrable, requiring the whalemen to resharpen their cutting tools constantly. Wood was used to start the fires beneath the tripods, but once the boiling process had begun, the crispy pieces of blubber floating on the surface of the pot, known as scraps or cracklings, were skimmed off and tossed into the fire for fuel. The flames that melted down the whale's blubber were thus fed by the whale itself. While this was a highly efficient use of materials, it produced a thick pall of black smoke with an unforgettable stench. "The smell of the burning cracklings is too horribly nauseous for description," remembered one whaleman. "It is as though all the odors in the world were gathered together and being shaken up." At night, the deck of the Essex looked like something out of Dante's Inferno. "A trying-out scene has something peculiarly wild and savage in it," stated a greenhand from Kentucky, "a kind of indescribable uncouthness, which renders it difficult to describe with anything like accuracy. There is a murderous appearance about the blood-stained decks and the huge masses of flesh and blubber lying here and there, and a ferocity in the looks of the men, heightened by the red, fierce glare of the fires." It was a scene that perfectly suited Melville's sinister artistic purposes in Moby Dick. "The darkness was licked up by the fierce flames," Ishmael tells us, "which at intervals forked forth from the sooty flues and illuminated every lofty rope in the rigging, as with the famed Greek fire. The burning ship drove on as if remorselessly commissioned to some vengeful act." Trying out a whale could take as long as 3 days. Special try watches were set, lasting between 5 and 6 hours, and affording the men scant sleep. Experienced whalemen knew enough to sleep in their trying out clothes, usually an old short-sleeved shirt and a worn pair of woolen drawers, postponing any attempts at cleaning themselves until the casks of oil had been stored in the hold and the ship had been thoroughly scrubbed down. Nickerson and his friends, however, were so revolted by the noisome mixture of oil, blood, and smoke covering their skin and clothes that they changed after every watch. By the time the first whale had been tried out, they had ruined nearly every piece of clothing stored in their sea chests. This forced them to purchase additional clothing from the ship's slop chest, the nautical equivalent of the company store, at outrageous prices. Nickerson estimated that if the Essex ever made it back to Nantucket, he and his fellow greenhands would owe the ship's owners close to 90% of their total earnings from the voyage. Instead of warning the teenagers about the potential perils of dipping into the slop chest, the ship's officers were content to let them learn the economics of whaling life the hard way. Nickerson's judgment? This should not have been. One night, not far from the Falkland Islands, the men were up in the rigging, reefing the topsails, when they heard a scream, a sharp, shrill shriek of terror coming from alongside the ship. Someone had apparently fallen overboard. The officer of the watch was about to give the order to heave to when a second scream was heard. And then, perhaps with a nervous laugh, someone realized that it wasn't a man, but a penguin, bobbing beside the ship, piercing the night with its all-too-human cries. Penguins? They must be nearing Antarctica. The next day the wind vanished, leaving the Essex to languish in a complete calm. Seals played about the ship, plunging and swimming as though they desired our attention, Nickerson remembered. There were several varieties of penguins, along with gulls and gannets, pinwheeling in the sky, a sure sign that the Essex was approaching land. While the seals and birds may have provided a distraction, morale about the Essex had reached a nadir. So far, it had been a slow and unprofitable slog toward Cape Horn. With the knockdown several days out from Nantucket setting the unfortunate tone of the voyage, they had been more than 4 months at sea and had only a single whale to show for it. If the voyage continued in this fashion, the Essex would have to be out a good deal longer than 2 years if she were to return with a full cargo of oil. With the temperatures dropping and the legendary dangers of the Horn looming ahead of them, tensions aboard the Essex were reaching the breaking point. Richard Henry Dana experienced firsthand how the morale of a ship's crew could deteriorate to the extent that even the slightest incident might be perceived as a horrendous, unbearable injustice. A thousand little things, daily and almost hourly occurring, which no one who has not himself been on a long and tedious voyage can conceive of or properly appreciate. Little wars and rumors of wars, reports of things said in the cabin, misunderstanding of words and looks, apparent abuses, brought us into a state in which everything seemed to go wrong. Aboard the Essex, the crew's discontent focused on the issue of food. At no time were the differences that existed between the officers and the men more pronounced than at mealtimes. In the cabin, the officers ate much as they did back home on Nantucket, on plates, with forks, knives, and spoons, and with plenty of vegetables, as long as they lasted, to add to the ship's fare of salt beef and salt pork. If there was fresh meat available, as from those 30 Mayo hogs, the officers were the ones who enjoyed most of it. As an alternative to hardtack, biscuits with the consistency of dried plaster, the steward regularly provided the officers with freshly baked bread. The men in the forecastle and steerage enjoyed an entirely different dining experience. Instead of sitting at a table to eat, they sat on their sea chests around a large wooden tub known as a kid, containing a hunk of pork or beef. Referred to as horse or junk, the meat was so salty that when the cook placed it in a barrel of salt water for a day to render it soft enough to chew, the meat's salt content was actually lowered. The sailors were required to supply their own utensils, usually a sheath knife and a spoon, plus a tin cup for tea or coffee. Rather than the heaping portions provided to the officers, those before the mast were given only a negligible amount of this less-than-nutritious fare, their daily diet of hardtack and salt beef occasionally augmented with a little duff, a flour pudding or dumpling boiled in a cloth bag. It has been estimated that sailors in the latter part of the 19th century were consuming around 3,800 calories a day. It is unlikely that the men in the forecastle of a whaler in 1819 consumed even close to that amount. Complained one green hand on a Nantucket whaler, "Alas, alas, the day that I came a-whaling. For what profiteth a man if he gain the whole world, but in the meantime starveth to death?" One day, soon after passing the Falkland Islands, the men went below to find in the kid a ration of meat even paltrier than usual. An impromptu meeting was held. It was decided that no one would touch the meat until the kid had been shown to Captain Pollard and a complaint officially filed. The sailors took their stations on the forward portion of the deck while one of the men, the tub of beef on his shoulder, made his way aft toward the cabin gangway. Nickerson, who had been assigned to tar the netting of the main staysail, was well above the deck and had a good view of the ensuing confrontation. The kid was no sooner set down than Captain Pollard came up onto the quarterdeck. Pollard glanced at the tub of beef, and Nickerson watched as his complexion seemed to shift from red to blue to almost black. Food was a difficult and sensitive issue for Captain Pollard. As he knew better than anyone, the Essex had been woefully under-provisioned by the parsimonious owners. If there was any hope of providing for the men in the several years ahead, he had to limit their provisions now. He may not have felt good about it, but he had no alternative. In bringing the kid aft, the men had dared to violate the sacred space of the quarterdeck, normally reserved for the officers. Even if the crew's anger might be justified, this was a challenge to the ship's authority that no self-respecting captain could tolerate. It was a critical moment for a commander who desperately needed to shake his crew out of a corrosive and potentially disastrous malaise. Casting aside his normal reticence, Pollard roared out, "Who brought this kid aft? Come here, you damned scoundrels, and tell me! No one dared speak. The men sheepishly made their way toward the quarterdeck as a group, each trying to hide himself behind the others. It was just the display of timidity this first-time captain needed. Pollard paced the quarterdeck in a fury, working a quid of tobacco in his mouth and spitting on the deck, all the while muttering, "You'll throw your kid in my face, you damned scoundrels, will you?" Finally, he made his way to the forward part of the quarterdeck, pulled off his jacket and hat, and stamped on them. "You scoundrels," he snarled. "Have not I given you all the ship could afford? Have not I treated you like men? Have you had plenty to eat and drink? What in hell do you want more? Do you wish me to coax you to eat, or shall I chew your food for you?" The men stood there, dumbfounded. Pollard's eyes strayed up into the rigging where Nickerson sat with his tar brush. Pointing a finger at him, the captain bellowed, "Come down here, you young rascal. I'll kill the whole bunch of you together and then bang up northwest and go home." Not having any idea what the captain meant by banging up northwest, Nickerson slunk down to the deck, fully expecting to be, if not killed, at least flogged. But much to everyone's relief, Pollard dismissed all hands, saying, "If I hear any more from you about provisions, I'll tie the whole of you up together and whip it out of you." As the crew dispersed, Pollard could be heard growling what became known among the men as his soliloquy, which they parodied in a bit of doggerel that Nickerson still remembered 57 years later. 30 hogs in the Isle of May, duff every other day, butter and cheese as much as you could sway, and now you want more beef, damn you. Pollard's behavior was fairly typical of Nantucket whaling captains, who were famous for oscillating wildly between tight-lipped reserve and incandescent rage. Pollard was, according to Nickerson, generally very kind where he could be so. This display of violence was only one of his freaks and passed off with the setting sun. The next morning found him as kind as before. Yet everything aboard the Essex had changed. Captain Pollard had proved he had the backbone to put the men in their place. From that day forward, no one ever complained.